the copy of the article you have, but then we were discussing multi-factor effect, and I was trying to use the help of a few other members of this community, and they were kind of surprised with that, but I appreciate their honesty. Let me drop. Obviously, the only person, and it was the only person who had an idea or knowledge in this area was Dick, the mentor of this event. If you know that person. Now, what is actually is kind of strange to me is that multi-factor effect exists in the accelerators, in the ham radio amplifiers, especially the tube one, and also exists in radars, waveguides, when there is an ambient temperature, and it also exists in dielectrics. Glass is a dielectric, let me drop. Okay, so I was thinking that if we have a situation in which the multi-factor effect will appear because in the environment that is completely linear, at the certain circumstances we have in areas of non-linearity, and then we have the extreme amount of the power being concentrated, whether this recent discovery could also, within the glass, be created not by delivering a certain amount of light through the square centimeter, but simply by creating an environment by creating a special electromagnetic field or concentration of special electromagnetic field in the particular area. You know what I'm saying. Back to you, Dick.
What I think you're saying and what I know right now is in conflict. Free space, we've measured it for 100 years, and we think it's got an impedance of 377 ohms. Every electromagnetic wave that you and I transmit through free space, if you know the power of that wave, watts per square meter, or whatever units you're using, because the impedance of space is 377 ohms, in theory you know exactly how many volts is on that particular electromagnetic wave, and how much magnetic field is in that electromagnetic wave. Once that electromagnetic wave enters this dielectric material, this magic glass, and the article you seem to be reading seems to be saying that the magnetic field gets magnified some large number of times, millions of times or whatever. Is that really a power increase? Am I really getting that amount of increase in solar energy into my solar voltaic? Now, one of the latest articles I've read in the last couple of days, and I can't remember which issue it was, but I'll find it. There's a company that's now invented a solar cell that's got almost 41% efficiency of converting solar energy into electric energy. So solar cells are going to get more popular, they're going to get more efficient, and it's a fabrication problem, they're going to get cheaper. Let me drop.
Momentic.
John recognized, but to make the magnetic portion suddenly get extremely large because it has entered this particular piece of glass, what happened to the electric portion, and is it really a power increase or an efficiency increase? I haven't read this article yet, so maybe you know a lot more about it. Let's just see what John's going to say on this. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I just wanted to remind Wesley, he didn't give you the numbers. This effect only happens with 10 million watts per square centimeter.
Yes, it is happening, but at the same time, the 10 million watts per square centimeter is a responsible amount of energy per micrometer. And when we had a very interesting discussion last night, we found that, and also it's in the article, that a fiber optic could be one of the sources of the light for the purpose. And then the concentration of the light, especially when the light is a laser light, could serve the purpose. What I was trying to ask you is first, if you can describe to the audience what is the multifactor effect, and then we go further.
Yeah, multifactor effect was first recognized on the Gemini space program as far as popular dissemination of information is concerned. Probably in other laboratories you already knew about it, but in a vacuum environment where you're expressing voltage across metallic objects, this is the way it usually happens, not the only way, but in order to have multifactor, you must have enough voltage, usually impressed by a metallic set of probes, in a vacuum or near vacuum environment. In that particular environment, a free electron, and by the way, an antenna normally does not launch electrons. When I listened to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts, when they were on the moon and they were transmitting a signal back from their lunar rover car or from their lunar lander back toward Earth, and I listened to some of those signals, there was a radio signal going through space, but no electrons left that antenna per se. So just normal transmission does not require electrons to leave the antenna. Electrons, without a doubt, are moving back and forth between the two halves of a dipole, if that's the kind of antenna you're using. Let me drop. But once I have a vacuum environment, once I have a strong enough E field, and once I have the right kind of spacing of those probes and the right kind of materials, if a cosmic ray comes along, hits one of your pieces of metal, and an electron gets freed, and now in this oscillating E field, the electron moves to the other probe, the other metallic object, strikes it with enough velocity that it frees more than one electron. And now that two electrons released on the second probe on the other half cycle are going to move in the other direction, and if they hit with enough velocity, those two electrons release four, and so on. You eventually get a runaway effect, a chain reaction-like effect, and the net result is you eventually end up with a cloud of electrons bouncing back and forth between the two metallic objects when the RF signal is present. That happened on the Gemini program, and it almost created a communication failure. In order for multipactor to take place, you need about three or four characteristics: the right angles of the metal, the right distance between the metals, or the right amount of E field, and the right work function of the metals. In other words, the metals themselves must have a certain characteristic so that when an electron hits that metal, it frees up another electron. If you do have multipactor in your antenna, there's about three ways you can cure it. Let me drop it. You may be able to change the angles of the metal so that the electrons hitting don't hit at the right angle to free up electrons. You can decrease the signal, you can change the angles, and you can coat your metals with some other substance that doesn't free up electrons anywhere near as easily. The materials you put onto the cathode of a vacuum tube are made to free electrons. You don't want to use those materials on an antenna that you're about to put into space. Those are the wrong materials. There are other materials that don't emit very well. So there's way, once you recognize what multipactor is, there's a number of ways you can cure it. Now, that's multi-pactor with metallic objects. One of the articles that Wesley mailed me said there's also a multi-pactor effect that occurs with a dielectric material. I didn't get deep enough into that one to understand it. And maybe Wesley or John can give us some more information on that one. And 2XJN first, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2XJN. Well, I have a problem with this statement. At first, it does appear in a vacuum or near vacuum environment, but at the same time, it could appear in waveguides. Ambient temperature, no vacuum. It could also appear on dielectrics. And this multivector effect occurs in dielectric surface often, and RF electric field is parallel to the surface. So the positive charge accumulated on the dielectric surface returns electron back to the surface. We can also deal with a single surface multifactor event that is possible on the metallic surface in the presence of cross-static magnetic field. So it looks like it is not a vacuum, but it's a cross-static magnetic field that is responsible mostly for multifactor effect. And by that token, when we are talking about a completely linear ham radio amateur amplifier, A-class, you said that in this tube we may have a situation in which we have areas of non-linearity. How can we create the areas of non-linearity in waveguides? And to assume.
Yeah, let me backtrack to waveguides. Lots and lots of radars using waveguides have run into an arcing effect. Improperly used waveguide with a strong enough microwave signal going down that waveguide will arc over the waveguide. And that's a huge nonlinearity when it occurs, because the arc itself, the arc in air, is an extremely negative impedance material. So when you get an arc in waveguide, I'm curious now how you differentiate a arc in waveguide running at atmospheric pressure. How do you differentiate that ordinary air arc for multipactor? Is it really multipactor in the waveguide, or is it a misrepresentation? Maybe you've got more information on that one, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
No, it is not a misrepresentation. It does exist. And I believe that since we touched the vacuum and the tubes, and we touch the dielectric, we should also say something about the multifactors on metals, where the vacuum is not necessity. The multifactor effect that occurs in the gap between two metallic electrodes is often the RF electric field at the normal surface. A resonance between electron flight time and RF field cycle is a mechanism for multifactor development. The existence of multifactor depends on the following three conditions being met. The average number of electrons released is greater or equal to 1/10 incidence per incidence electron, and the time taken by the electron to travel from the surface from which it was released to the surface, it impacts within an integer multiple of a 1/2 of the RF period, and the third one was the average secondary electron yield is greater or equal to 1. Now,
Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is dead.
Thank you for this information. Well, a great change, I would say. Now, my understanding is that multi-factor effect does exist also in ambient environment, so it might exist as a factor of non...
Hello, hello, Jeff.
Therefore, this, I brought to your attention also the ultraviolet light, and the spark by itself created light as well. Now, the certain surfaces, which was, would be phosphorite surfaces, or John would actually describe it better, we have a memory, a great memory, long-time memory, with the ultraviolet light. That means we could paint with the ultraviolet LED of 390 nanometers, ultraviolet LED, we can paint the pictures on it, and it holds for even hours. Although the immediate, let's say 20, 30 seconds, you can see it very bright on the surface. Now, if the light could be responsible, magnetic component of the light could be responsible for the 100 million times of application in glass, that my understanding is that it is not just the regular glass, but could be lead-based glass or the glass with the special properties. And I wonder if that multi-factor effect could not only come from the light from the sun, but let's say with the environment of cross-sectional magnetic field created by spark up of Tesla.
When I've got air present, and each of those air molecules at standard temperature and pressure are on average 3 nanometers apart, and an air molecule only has 63 nanometers of mean free path. That's a very short distance. In order to get multi-factor electron cloud to move back and forth between the two probes in the presence of air, that air is a huge blockage, very similar to what happens in a vacuum tube. A vacuum tube stops working because the electrons are continuously hitting the air molecules. If air is present in that tube, you allow air to go into the tube, it stops being a tube. It stops having any amplification or any real signal flow from cathode to anode.
It's something.
Now,
I sent you the YouTube in which that experiment, the gentleman said that in my replication I was able to move the plasma inside the neon. So we're not talking about air, we're talking about the plasma environment, which actually light might be a plasma, especially when the light goes through the fiber optic to this particular region of the glass to magnify the magnetic component of the light, and it comes from laser. Now, what he said, that gentleman, that he was using 290 nanometers ultraviolet LED, and he was able to move a position of plasma inside the neon. So, if you can state about not really ambient air, but air at a certain condition.
Earlier you were talking about 25 million watts per square centimeter. If I have a signal of that magnitude, I can get all kinds of arcing and sparking and maybe multi-factor and whatever. On top of that, if I've got that kind of power flux density, that huge a number, which I think is going to arc over anything you've got, I also worry about what kind of instrumentation you used to confirm that power flux density. 25 million watts per square centimeter is just a number that's sort of out of sight.
10 million, Dick.
A magnifying glass could make the temperature states about the concentration per given area, which would be micrometers of the power. Back to you.
Oh, I see. I was thinking it was 25 million. It's only 10 million. Oh, that's a small signal. I was following your joke. Yeah, those kind of power levels, all kinds of nonlinearity will take place.
All right,
give me that again, John.
A quick question. Convert that from roughly 1,000 watts, roughly, per square meter. What kind of a lens would we need to focus that much sun energy?
Lens from the area.
Yeah, I think I know where John's going here. The sun gives you something like 1290 watts per square meter at the surface of the outer atmosphere. In other words, the sun is giving you a little bit more than a kilowatt per square meter of solar power flux density on a sunny day. And now you make that go up to 10 million watts per square centimeter. There are what? 10,000 square centimeters per square meter. So you multiply by 10,000. And then you also tell me that it was 10 million watts per square centimeter instead of, let me think now. Solar energy, if I take a kilowatt and multiply it, but divide by 10,000, I've got 0.1 milliwatt, I think it is. The sun is giving you 0.1 milliwatt per square centimeter, if I did the math right. Very close to 0.1 milliwatt per square centimeter. And now you want to go from 0.1 milliwatt, did I do that right? 1,000 divided by 10,000. No, it's 0.1 watt. 0.1 watt per square centimeter. If I go from 0.1 watt up to 10 million, that's a ratio of 100 million to 1. So you're making the amount of energy per square centimeter go 100 million to 1 stronger than direct sunlight. You start talking about those kind of power flux densities. All kinds of nonlinearity. Under that condition, can you get multi-factor? I'm going to give you that, even in air. You're going to ram it right through the air, if you know what I mean. But under normal circumstances, I'm having trouble believing that at a reasonable power level, you can get multi-factor in a waveguide with air being present. In a vacuum waveguide, absolutely. But with air being present, you can get all kinds of arcing and sparking. And then they call it multi-factor. How do we know it is real multi-factor? Let me pass it to you on that one first, John. Have you read something that led you to believe that you can get...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
John, have you read something that would lead you to believe that at normal, reasonable power levels in a piece of waveguide, I can get multi-factor with air present? Do you remember reading anything like that? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Negative, Dick. I've never read anything about that at all in waveguide. No experience at all, so that I can't add anything to. Don't forget to leave a little time for your Times article.
Yeah, it turns out there's a website we can all go to, but maybe you have to sign in, maybe you have to give them some money. But you can look at past archives, and you can go to a library. But April 17th, the Sunday issue, the color section of the newspaper, the magazine section, has this article, Do Cell Phones Create Brain Cancer? Extremely well-written article, about 7 pages long. And if this is the best of all worlds, in order to confirm that cell phones can create brain cancer, brain tumors, you'd like the survey you've done to be a large enough portion of the population with enough incidence that the whole analysis becomes statistically significant. There's the problem. Of all the kinds of brain tumors that people get, some percentage of them, there are individuals who have claimed that that particular brain tumor was caused by my cell phone because it has just the right shape and just the right side of my head. And that's where I hold my cell phone. That's kind of a circumstantial or a type of situation. There's a name for that, but you know what I mean. Is it significant? If this is the best of all worlds, let me drop. You'd like to investigate, let me pick a number, 100,000 individuals, and you would like to break the 100,000 individuals. Let's start off with 200,000 individuals. 100,000 of them, you have them used cell phones for the next 10 or 20 years, and you keep track of them. And the other 100,000 individuals never use a cell phone for the next 10 or 20 years, and you keep track of them. There's three reasons why you can't do that. Number one, to try to find any significant number of individuals who have never used a cell phone for 10 or 20 years, that's almost impossible. Second of all, right now, the known brain tumor rate is 6.4 brain tumors total per 100,000 people. And some small percentage of those 6.4 brain tumors per 100,000 people, you believe, could be caused by a cell phone. The statistics there are much too small to be able to figure out what's going on. Let me give you an example of that. At least until the last couple of years, 40,000 Americans per year die in automobile accidents. Let me drop. That sounds like a very big number, but that's only 12.9 people per 100,000 in the population. If you've got 100,000 people in the population, in theory, 12.9 of them are going to die this year in an automobile accident. So as big as the rate of automobile accidents is, in numbers per 100,000, it's small. And brain tumors are roughly half that number. So to prove it, as far as an epidemiological study is concerned, is very difficult. Very, very difficult.
But I have a problem with that, Dick.
Go ahead with your problem, John.
We basically all have the same cranial system. Basically, all the same. Cell phones have about the same power output or have to meet that certain demand. There's an awful lot of people using cell phones. Shouldn't it be much higher?
I think I see where you're going, and I'm with you. First of all, when it comes to the mechanism, in the case of nuclear energy, where each individual photon of nuclear energy has a tremendous amount of power, they are microscopic bullets moving at close to the speed of light. And as each one of those microscopic bullets penetrates my body, without a doubt, each one of them is going to do some amount of damage. And if they're damaging my DNA, and if they damage it beyond a certain point where the error-correcting code built into my DNA that's operative each time a cell goes through mitosis, I mean, when I look at John WGB today, most of what I see today will not be there 1 month from today. Yeah, the ends of his hair will be there, and the ends of his fingernails will be there, but most of the skin cells that I see will be replaced. There's continuous cell replacement going on, and the DNA makes sure that the next generation of cells that get replaced on everything that I see are very close to the John that I saw the last time, if you know what I mean. So the replication process and the accuracy with which it's doing it is very dependent on that DNA, and you don't want to damage that DNA. And these microscopic bullets coming out of nuclear material are damaging that. Radio energy doesn't have that effect. The only thing radio energy has is a word in the dictionary. We call it radio frequency radiation as opposed to nuclear radiation. Those two words are equal in the word radiation, but we're not even comparing an apple to an orange here. An apple and an orange are both fruit. When you compare nuclear radiation to radio radiation, you're comparing an apple to a piece of paper. There's that much difference. Let me drop. So it is well known that when you go below optical frequencies into the near infrared, far infrared, high microwave, medium microwave, no microwave, as you go lower and lower in frequency, the total amount of energy per photon is getting smaller and smaller in a linear manner. It's the Planck equation. So the amount of energy per photon of a radio wave is much too small to do any kind of cell damage at reasonable power levels. Yes, I can put my hamburger in a convection oven, and the heat of that convection oven does some chemical change to the food that you and I call cooking. Or correspondingly, I can put my hamburger in a microwave oven, and the heating of that microwave does an extremely similar process of cooking my food. But that microwave oven is creating a power flux density, is there's a kilowatt of energy being injected into the 700 watts in my 750 watts in my particular microwave oven is going into the small cavity, and all of that energy is bouncing back and forth many times before the food finally absorbs it. So the total power flux density is probably quite a few kilowatts per square meter. Huge amount of power.
Comment on this concentration of the energy.
Go ahead. You talking about the microwave oven now? Go ahead.
Not necessarily microwave oven, but we're talking about very short wavelength of the sunlight, and we just use the few centimeters across the rectifying glass, and we want to concentrate that energy to melt a piece of steel, let's say. We can do it with 1 watt only. If, let's say, the area that could be covered is 0.1 100,000 squared of the centimeter. And the basis for this argument is that the small light bulb filament, 1 watt power, cannot be made out of steel, but has to be made from tungsten to avoid melting. So my understanding is that we don't need a very strong, high power just to concentrate a huge amount of sun energy on the very small area. Back to you.
Okay. Let me take that and go all the way forward. We're breaking away from the cell phone discussion for a minute, but we're going to come back to it. If I use a bigger and bigger and bigger magnifying glass to take sunlight and concentrate it into an extremely small dot, and I allow you to make the magnifying glass as big as you want, I'll let you make it a mile in diameter if you like. Do you believe you could create such a concentration with your magnifying glass that I'm letting you make as big as you like, and you're making a very small hot spot dot? Can you make that dot hotter than the surface of the sun? That's my question to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW?
No, and never.
Give that man a cigar. You're absolutely right. Because if you did that, the energy would be flowing in the wrong direction. It would be flowing from your dot to back toward the sun. There's two limitations there. No matter how much you concentrate, the temperature cannot be greater than the temperature of your source when you're using...
And when I was a child, we were playing with the teacher with a magnifying glass and a black piece of glass. We were able to burn a hole with... the glass, inside the glass. The glass was brown, dark brown. Back to you.
Yeah, there's some laws of physics where you cannot focus electromagnetic energy into a space that is smaller than a wavelength, and maybe even a couple of wavelengths, but you can't get smaller than a wavelength. So no matter what you do, there's a limit to how much concentration at a particular wavelength. The good news about a laser is that all of those waves are coherent. They're all in phase with each other. It allows you to do a much better focusing job, and they're all on one very small bandwidth of frequency. So the combination of very narrow frequency, all in phase, coherent, allows you to get much higher concentrations than you've ever seen before. So laser light is able to give you some extremely high power flux densities. But still, there's a limit to how much you can concentrate. You can't get smaller than a wavelength in the way you focus it. And so this 10 million watts per square centimeter, where did that energy come from? Over to you, Wesley, K2LIW.
Good question. I have no answer. What I have is the article that stands about the fact that it could be done. And they mention a fiber optics in it. So My understanding is that it must be way around, and the paper was only to announce to the people such phenomenon, but the secret of that technology is not been published yet. Coming back to that experiment that I had made as a child with the teacher, the glass was containing metal oxide and quartz component, and it wasn't just regular glass, was dark brown and was thin, and we were able to melt that just by using a set of magnifying glasses from the using the sun light of the sun. Back to you.
Yeah, it's easy to make not easy, but it's possible to make glass that is optically not transparent, but yet either the ultraviolet or the infrared is getting through the glass, and the sun puts out enough of those energies that they're properly focused, it can give you some significant heating. The green glass that they put inside of a 35 millimeter projector tries to remove the thermal energy from the light bulb that you've got in your projector so that you're not overheating that slide. Let me get back to the cell phone for a minute. We got to the point where the incident is very small. The number of brain tumors and what fraction of those small number of brain tumors, 6.4 brain tumors per 100,000 in the population, what fraction of those are caused by a cell phone? I think the fraction is extremely small. And even if there was proof that a very small percentage of the population is susceptible to cell phone exposure creating a brain tumor, should we therefore outlaw cell phones? We kill 40,000 people per year in automobiles. We don't outlaw automobiles. We accept that risk. There's a risk-benefit ratio of everything we do. You can't live a life with zero risk. The total amount of benefit from cell phones, the total number of people's lives who are being saved because the cell phone is used to call first responders, emergency personnel, to an accident scene, and if you get them there fast enough, let me drop. If you get them there fast enough, a lot of those people will survive. So even if we could prove that cell phones do create some amount of biological grief to the people, and we haven't proven it, and we've been looking for those effects. I mean, the American National Standards Institute, with that C95 report, which is the best place that has summed it all together, 1,000 references there from your best testing laboratories and your best institutions, and for 60 years they've been looking for the non-thermal effect of RF energy, the human damage that it can create. At reasonable exposure levels that are a lot lower than your microwave oven, it isn't there. They haven't found it. So by all of the 60 years of evidence we've got, it appears as though cell phones are quite safe. And the safest thing about the cell phone is the base station. And the base station is the thing that everybody's trying to eliminate. Hempstead Town, Bayville Town, Cliffside Town, and Seacliff. Seacliff and, let's see now, one of the Hamptons, East Hampton, and now Huntington, is coming up with zoning laws that are trying to restrict cell sites. And they're not calling it biohazard, but it's hidden in the specification. They're saying no cell sites within 500 feet of a residence, of a school, or of a place of worship. That outlaws everything in the town. Let me drop. This coming Tuesday, Huntington Town is going to have a public meeting, public hearing, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Town Hall on whether or not they should approve this new zoning ordinance they're coming up with saying that cell sites can't be within 500 feet. They're not saying it, but it's hidden in there that they think that there's a radio frequency biohazard. They're trying to get around what Congress elected in 1996, the Communication Act of 1996, saying that you can't deny the sighting of a cell site based on what you think is radio frequency biohazard, because there is no evidence that it exists. So it's a peculiar situation. We've got a vocabulary problem called radiation. We've got a perceived risk where people think that some kind of brain tumors are happening, but they can't prove it. And lots of studies have gone into trying to prove it. No success yet. And even if you could prove that one person per 100,000 is getting a brain tumor from a cell phone, that wouldn't allow you to outlaw them, because you're killing one person per 100,000 in the worst case scenario, but maybe you're saving 100 people or 1,000 people because of the first responders being able to get there during an accident because of the use of the cell phone. The risk to benefit ratio is considerably higher than using an automobile. Considerably higher than using an automobile, and we don't outlaw automobiles. Let me tell you about telephone poles. Up and down every one of the streets in most of the counties that we know about, every 150 feet, you have a utility pole. A high percentage of all those 40,000 people who die per year die because their automobile strikes a utility pole. Those things are dangerous. We don't even see them. We don't recognize it as a danger. So our methods of evaluating risk assessment is mildly crazy from a scientific point of view. A person from Europe can come to the United States and say, how in the world do you tolerate all of that ugliness of all of that above-ground wiring? And the answer is, we do not see it. It's been there forever. We don't see it. Our mind is blind to it because it's always been there. If we didn't have this current craziness, our mind would become blind to cell sites. They're safe. You may object to their aesthetic impact, and if your particular house is next door to one, maybe you can make a case that the value of your house has gone down a little bit because of aesthetics, because of the beauty. And it's about time that somebody come up with a good way of making the cell site look like a real tree, not these horrible trees that they tried to do in the past. There's ways of hiding it, if you think there's an aesthetic problem. But if you think there's a radio frequency biohazard problem, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that says there is none. And to start writing laws which are creating moratoriums, creating delays in installations, which is creating a great big waste of money, time, anguish, and you're denying the use and the installation of a safety item. That's crazy. Each time a cell site, each time a cell company wants to put up a cell site, it costs them roughly $500,000 per installation. And the craziness of the rule in Hempstead Town is that you must give them a whole lot of mathematics proving that you needed it. Come on. It's a profit-making organization. If it's going to cost them $500,000 per installation and they're willing to make that investment, that is proof positive they think there is a need. They wouldn't do it otherwise. And to force them to give you a whole lot of metrics proving that there's a need, and the town doesn't know how in the world to evaluate the metrics. They're demanding the metrics, but they can't use it. So they hire this expert from Florida who interprets it for them. He happens to be the same guy that told them to ask for the metrics. And then he's the guy that defends the town in the court of law. He's got a beautiful situation going there. Boy, he's got a license to print money. And how in the world can a town with intelligent people like Hempstead fall into that trap? And now Huntington Town is copying Hempstead. Craziness. What's going on there is that the people in Hempstead and the people in Huntington don't know what they don't know. They are not aware of what they don't know. They're in the first state of knowledge of this five states of knowledge. They're not smart enough to know, they don't know, to ask the right question. Is there really a danger? And do we need these moratoriums? And do we need these crazy 500-foot numbers? Of course the answer is no. I'm off my hobby horse. You see where I stand on this one. This is some of my impressions of the article. I've gone a little bit off to one side, but the article is very well written, and you have various ways of getting it. Maybe you want to fill in something there, John. KC2WGB, the guy who asked the question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2IKT with a comment on future of cell sites.
Station recognized. Dick, I'm looking at, just like you are, the benefit ratio. Now, what about drugstores? Perfectly legal prescribed drugs, used the way the doctor tells you to use them. I bet you are killing more people in that town than cell phones are causing cancer. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. The misuse of pharmaceuticals and just the misuse of something very innocent called salt. Two very pivotal articles appeared in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, and a more recent one appeared in New England Journal of Medicine. And the bottom line of both of those articles, after a great big study, was that between 90,000 and 140,000 Americans per year would not die if we simply lower the sodium intake in their diet. That's a lot of life. That's two, three, four times the accident rate of automobiles. And our packaged foods, our processed foods, have a tremendous amount of salt in it because the food packagers think that the American taste wants it, and it drastically increases shelf life. And they like the shelf life to increase because they don't get them coming back when they've spoiled. George, W2IKT, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. My only comment was going to be today's cell sites are pretty much spaced based on 3G and 2G type cell technology. As we get into 4G cell technology, which has promised people basically an order of magnitude increase in data rate, that translates pretty much to an order of magnitude increase in the raw bandwidth necessary to make that happen. And the only place where they're going to be able to squeeze an order of magnitude more out of Shannon's law is to make the path between the transmitter and the receiver a bit more predictable, which means cell site spacing, the spacing between towers, has to come down for 4G cell sites to properly blanket an area. So the emerging generation of cell technology is basically calling for, in round numbers, an order of magnitude more sites per square zoning area to be covered. And just think about what that's going to do to the zoning. Back to you, Dick.
You make a very good point, George. There's going to be a lot more cell sites of the normal kind. There's going to be a lot more mini cell sites and micro cell sites and nano cell sites within buildings. They're going to be all over the place. They're going to be scattered on utility poles, in buildings, to irrigate a building with RF so that there's no dead spots and so on. We're demanding more and more bandwidth. There's going to be more and more of them. But the safest thing in the world is the cell site itself. That cell phone against your head, a quarter of an inch away, is giving you more than 1 million times more RF energy into that near part of your head compared to what would happen if you lived directly next door to the cell site base station and the second floor of your house as your child's bedroom facing that cell site. When that child picks up that cell phone and does text messaging or does kind of conversation with it against their head, they're getting 1 million times more energy into that near part of their head than the cell site itself when the cell site is running maximum power during a rush hour. You say those words to a normal person doing zoning or whatever, and they'll think you're crazy. They don't understand the inverse square law. So the fact that more cell sites are going in is going to have an impact. Let me drop. It's going to have a tremendous impact on zoning. And the fact that these zoning moratoriums are being declared and these 500 rules are being declared and these metric requirements are being declared is crazy. It's creating delay. It's creating cost. When that cell company puts up a cell site and they estimate it's going to cost them $500,000, $250,000 of that is dedicated toward just the permit requirement. All the legal jazz. All these individual towns are over and over again creating all of these delays for no good reason. They get no benefit out of it. When Congress elected the Communication Act of 1996, they did that because they realized that town after town and state after state were coming up with these rules declaring that the cell sites are dangerous and they're going to be creating cancer. After 60 years of study, our federal government, in both this country and a hell of a lot of other countries, are convinced there is no radio frequency biohazard. So stop doing that. So they came up with the Communication Act of 1996 to stop that. But now people are sneaking it back in without using the words, but they're doing it by way of this 500-foot requirement, which has no basis in any kind of a fact. That number is a rabbit hat trick. The real number for safety from the cell site, if you are on the hook and ladder, on top of the ladder, right at the altitude of the cell site antenna, directly in front of it, and if you are 5 feet away from the antenna, and you stare directly into the antenna with your eyes open for the next 6 minutes, that is safe. As you start moving into 2 feet, you approach the threshold. At 1 foot, you've crossed the threshold when the cell site is running maximum power. So in the case of the Bayville school, where they're worried about the kids across the street being irradiated and being damaged and getting leukemia, they think, yes, the child does have a danger. Let me drop. Those children in that school in Bayville have a definite danger. If the child runs out of the school, runs across schoolyard road, I think it's called, climbs the fence where the water tower is, climbs the leg of the water tower, gets up to the circle around the water tower, climbs the ladder that goes over the tank of the water tower, climbs across the upper surface of the water tower, walks up to the cell site antenna, kneels in front of it, and kneels 2 feet away from it, he's safe. If he moves his body 1 foot away from the antenna, he has crossed the threshold of alarm with the current American and British standard. Is that child a danger? Absolutely. What the hell is the probability the child is going to do all that? Bayville is trying to remove every one of those cell site and law enforcement and police and fire, trying to remove all of those antennas from the town because of the perceived risk. Yeah, there is a risk if a child does all that. I think you see where I'm going on this one, George. KB2IKT, I think it is. K2RW. You might have some comments on this one, George. Go ahead. George first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, George.
Thanks, Nick. It's Whiskey Bravo 2, Andy and Kilowatt Tango. Anyway, yeah, the zoning laws don't seem to make a lot of sense. I do know that the revolution, and we're in the middle of it now, a technical revolution, where people want their data to go with them, no matter where they are, is leading to more and more powerful smartphones, PDA devices, iPads, tablet machines, more portable laptops, and a face of people in computing in the cloud, which is basically, very simply, that your data resides on the Internet someplace, and it doesn't matter where. As long as you can get to the Internet, you can get to your data. And the second point of cloud computing is that you don't need any special software because it's all written so that you access it via web browsers. So given those two facts, somewhere's on the web that you can get to, and only a web browser, that's one of the driving forces between making our network needs faster and faster and faster. It's one of the reasons why our video industry, broadcast industry, is more or less, transitioning from being a dedicated broadcast to making sure that the broadcast is distributed via the same Internet that distributes everything else to the same smart device, and it's going away from dedicated television. And it's very clear that that's had an immense impact on the tech entertainment industry, our radio industry, and so on. You know, the world isn't changing. We've got to get used to it. And by the way, that's a huge threat to our spectrum. There's something else we have to consider. Anyway, Dick, back to you, and I think it's going to go over to Eric.
An awful lot of what used to be called over-the-air broadcast is really now narrowcast by way of internet and fiber optics and so on. Eric, I guess I should calm down a little bit. Is that what you're about to tell me, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
No, self-regulation is a good thing. Actually, I wasn't, but yeah, I'm in your soapbox a little bit. But I'm curious, and I can't remember which university did it, There recently was a study where they did either a PET scan, a CAT scan of brain activity, and it was a double-blind study, and they put cell phones in along with the person as they were doing the scan, and they didn't know whether it was on or off. Have you heard about that one? Have you read about it?
When you do a scan like that, because the cell site, the cell phone, can create, let me pick a number, 1/10 or 2/10 of a degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature of local material, and I think a CAT scan or a MRI is capable of resolving things like that, you can measure a difference, but is it a real detriment is the first question. There also was a study of a double-blind test with operating and non-operating cell phones where people were doing mental mathematics, and the people with the operating cell phone, the slightly warmer head, were able to do the mental mathematics a little bit faster. Back to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, you know, I'll find the name of the study. It was, you know, there was no conclusion derived from it, but there was a very definite change in activity, and in a very specific area of the brain, which was quite curious. I was just wondering if you had any awareness of it, because I'll take, for example, in our physiological world, whales and porpoises and dolphins have the ability to detect magnetic fields, and they use that for navigation. There are all sorts of sensitivities that make a transition in the biological world, which we don't actually have any answers for why they exist. So, you know, it's not to say that it has zero effect. I mean, we know that the heating is a property, but, you know, we don't necessarily have the ability to discount that there is no effect. It doesn't have to, just doesn't have to be to a detriment, that's all.
Let me find out where you stand on all of this, Eric, with reference to cell phones. If you were the head of the FCC, or if you were the head of the Bureau of Radiological Health, if you had the power, and you see some of the foolish decisions being made by zoning boards and town boards and whatever with reference to cell sites, with your current knowledge, and if you had the power, would you make a change? And if so, what change would you make? I know this is a tough one if you haven't thought about it a whole lot until now. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, interestingly enough, I've had to take Richard Pell's RFR courses and stuff like that for, you know, dealing with high power and having to deal with FAR measurements. Most of these people are just out of their minds, so, you know. But, you know, we could go back to the 60s and 70s where your mobile phone was a giant box in the back of your car. I don't think people would take too well to that, so. Well, I would try and educate them that they're being a little ridiculous, you know. Hey, it is somewhat of a democracy, and you know, they've got all the people hypnotized and brainwashed into believing that what they say is true, you know, and they're the majority, they have every right to do what it is that they want to do. It's just that I generally don't agree too much with my representatives. But I'm only one person out of many, so, you know, it's kind of problematic. It isn't a totalitarian society where I could dictate what the rules are going to be. K2RIW, K2J.
John, recognize, we've got an educational problem. By a very slow process, we've got to convince the individuals that are trying to set these crazy zoning laws that they really don't know what they're doing. And of course, that's not going to go down easily. They're in the first state of knowledge where they don't know that they don't know. And to get them to admit that they don't know, and therefore they're making decisions without the required information, logical sounding decisions. They think they're responding to what their constituency wants. They think that their public wants control of these cell sites because they're dangerous. And they think they're responding to what's being required by the constituency. They really have a much higher priority, much higher requirement to properly educate that public as to whether or not their requests are reasonable. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
I'm educating Peter King.